content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the January 27th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows Joe Biden in his green Corvette. He's been pulled over on the side of the highway. He's sitting at the steering wheel. He's got his hands on it, and he's looking down sadly. A police officer looks like he's writing him a ticket. In the seat beside President Biden is a box, cardboard box, classified documents, and they're kind of disheveled, and then you can see some strewn about on the road behind him. The headline is, "A Costly Blunder, The Political and Legal Implications of Biden's Failure to Return Classified Documents." That is our first main story. We'll start with that. Biden's classified document fiasco. What happened? The White House went into damage control mode this week after embarrassing revelations about 16 classified documents had been found at President Biden's private Washington, D.C. office and Wilmington, Delaware home. Republicans pounced on the discovery, which may complicate a criminal investigation by Special Counsel Jack Smith into former President Trump's seizure and refusal to turn over more than 11,000 documents, including 300 marked classified. CBS News reported that on November 2nd of last year, Biden's lawyers found about 10 classified documents in a locked closet at a think tank office Biden kept after leaving the vice presidency in 2017. They turned them over to the National Archives, which alerted the Justice Department, triggering an investigation. But the White House didn't acknowledge this until the CBS report, and then did not reveal that a December search of Biden's home turned up a small number of classified documents in a garage and an adjacent room. Biden said he was surprised by the find. His lawyer said the documents were inadvertently misplaced. Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel, former federal prosecutor Robert Hur, to investigate. House Republicans began their own inquiry, demanding communications related to the searches. Some frustrated Democrats privately criticized how Biden and his spokespeople handled the matter, which the news of the document discoveries coming out twice. Months ago, Biden called Trump totally irresponsible for keeping classified documents. "It's a huge gift to Trump," said former Obama advisor David Axelrod. What the editorial said: "The Trump case looks a bit different now, doesn't it?" said the Wall Street Journal. "We've said all along that while Trump was inexplicably mulish about handing over his files, improperly holding documents is no reason to criminally prosecute a former president. Now that Biden's in the same boat, while laughably assuring Americans that the classified documents were locked up alongside his Corvette, maybe the left will agree that unleashing special counsels is overkill." "Not so fast," said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "Even a cursory look at the facts refutes GOP claims that the Trump and Biden cases are equivalent. The lawless Trump knowingly hoarded thousands of documents, including top-secret ones related to nuclear secrets, then stalled and obfuscated for months as the Justice Department tried to retrieve them. Biden immediately notified the National Archives about what clearly was a bungled handling of documents. The contrast is striking." What the columnist said: "This mess puts the White House in a tight spot just when things were looking good," said Christopher Catalego in Politico. Last week, one poll found Biden's approval rating had hit 50%. But he now faces weeks, if not months, of legal probing, speculation, and bad headlines, as well as a probe by House Republicans. Privately, Democrats worry the debacle could help validate GOP investigations they dismiss as politically motivated headaches. Garland was wise to appoint a special counsel to look into the Biden documents, but the two cases are not equivalent, said former U.S. Deputy Attorney General Donald Ayer in The Atlantic. Unlike Biden, Trump refused for 8 months to return government records that the archives realized were missing. When a subpoena was issued, he finally turned over 15 boxes of documents, and his lawyer falsely swore no more remained. But after security footage showed Trump employees moving boxes from a storage room, the FBI obtained a search warrant and seized upwards of 11,000 additional documents, including more than 70 marked secret or top secret. That obstruction is the real crime, and the Biden documents should have no impact on Trump's legal jeopardy. Maybe they shouldn't, but they might anyway, said Mona Shirin in Time. When caught doing bad things, Trump's perpetual defense is that everyone does it. Now Biden has handed him an enormous gift. He really did do something similar. The fact that what Trump did was orders of magnitude worse won't change the political calculus. If Garland prosecutes Trump while letting Biden off with a hand slap, he's going to lose badly in the court of public opinion, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Millions of Americans will conclude that Trump's paranoia about a deep state out to get him isn't so imaginary after all. Our controversy of the week, gas stoves, the new partisan battleground. Republicans' capacity for launching new dumb culture wars never ceases to amaze, said James Downey in MSNBC. Last week, Richard Trumka, Jr. of the Consumer Product Safety Commission was asked in an interview about the safety of gas stoves. Gas stoves not only leak methane and contribute to climate change, their flames create a host of noxious gases, including nitrogen dioxide and carbon monoxide, and fine particulates that can lodge in the lungs. A recent study found that gas stoves cause 13% of childhood asthma cases, totaling about 650,000 kids. Trumka offered the general observation that products that can't be made safe can be banned, and that was all it took. Before the White House could clarify that there is no plan to confiscate the 40 million gas stoves currently in use across America, or to issue a federal ban in the future, Republicans were flooding social media with visions of government agents busting down doors and ripping ovens out of walls. The right-wing perpetual outrage machine always needs a new target, said Alex Shepard in The New Republic. So this humble kitchen appliance has joined the plastic drinking straw, the incandescent light bulb, the cheeseburger, and the AR-15 as a sacred symbol of identity that the liberal elites will have to pry from conservatives' cold, dead hands. Talk about gaslighting, said Jonah Goldberg in The Dispatch. Sure, there was over-the-top rhetoric from Republicans last week. Representative Jim Jordan's solemn tweet, "God, guns, gas stoves," will live in infamy. But Republicans were reacting to what Trumka plainly said and meant until the uproar made him backtrack. As crazy as it sounds, liberal policymakers really are coming for your stove, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. San Francisco and New York City have already banned gas hookups in new construction. And just last week, New York Governor Kathy Hochul called for a statewide ban starting in 2025. In their hatred of fossil fuels, progressives really would rather impose their values on the rest of us. Besides, electric stoves create their own hazards, said Charles Cook in National Review. Their hot coils can ignite towels and fat even when turned off, and cause 80% of kitchen fires. The ranges progressives prefer have a civilian fire death rate 3.4 times that of gas stoves. Since electric stoves cannot, in Trumka's formulation, be made safe from fire hazards, should hyperactive progressives launch a moral crusade on them? Instead, how about letting the nation's adults equip their kitchens however they please? What's missing from this debate is a sense of proportion, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. It's true that cooking with gas creates unlovely byproducts you don't want in your house. But rather than hyping this modest danger, how about suggesting that people turn on the hood vent if they have one, or crack open the window? Politics aside, gas stoves might be doomed anyway, said Jacob Stern in The Atlantic. Many chefs and skilled home cooks are already switching to induction ranges that generate heat with electromagnetism. They offer more power and precision than gas or electric, pose virtually no fire hazard, don't create noxious emissions, and are easier to clean. They're more expensive, for now, but are also more efficient. Let's forget this silly culture war argument and inform people about the alternatives. May the best stove win. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for moving on. After 91-year-old media tycoon Rupert Murdoch, who divorced his fourth wife, model Jerry Hall, 6 months ago, was spotted on a beach vacation in Barbados with a new flame. Ann Leslie Smith, 66, the widow of late country star Chester Smith. It was a good week for the dancing queen after Sweden's new government proposed repealing regulations requiring restaurants and nightclubs to obtain a permit to allow dancing. It is not reasonable for the state to regulate people's dance, said Justice Minister Gunnar Stromer. And it was a good week for Obamacare, as the 2010 Affordable Care Act is known, with the news that 16 million people bought their 2023 health insurance through healthcare.gov, the highest number since ACA became law. New federal funding has substantially reduced premiums. But it was a bad week for privilege after a police video emerged of Larry Ellison, billionaire founder of Oracle, being pulled over for running a stop sign and speeding on the Hawaiian island of Lanai, which is 98% owned by Ellison. The cop politely tells the world's fifth richest person that he was kind of speeding there. It was a bad week for translation after the federal government fired a contractor who translated one of its messages into Alaska native languages to read, "Your husband is a polar bear, skinny." And finally, it was a bad week for cage matches, with a report that Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert had a screaming match in the House women's restroom during the fight over the House Speaker. The blow-up reportedly ended with Boebert yelling at Greene, "Don't be ugly." And a short and other news piece. GOP insiders knew of Santos' lies. Campaign aides and powerful GOP operatives knew that New York Congressman George Santos fabricated much of his resume long before he won a House seat last fall, the New York Times reported last week. In 2021, an internal background check, commissioned to anticipate how opponents might attack Santos, revealed that Santos had lied about the colleges he'd attended and where he'd worked, while concealing multiple evictions and links to a firm accused of running a Ponzi scheme. The findings caused several campaign staffers to quit. Santos is now accused of using a fake name for fundraisers, believing it sounded more Jewish. Despite the firestorm, House Republicans this week seated Santos on two committees. The briefing is the demise of local news. The U.S. is losing newspapers at the rate of more than two a week, at a steep cost to our communities and our democracy. How bad is the problem? The U.S. has lost more than 2,500 newspapers since 2005, or 25% of the total, and is on track to lose a third by 2025, according to a 2022 report by Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. The result is a growing number of Americans, now approaching 70 million, who live in a news desert, a community with no local news source. Most of those shuttered papers are weeklies covering smaller communities, but larger daily papers are dying as well. In 2019, Youngstown, Ohio became the biggest U.S. city without a newspaper when the 150-year-old Vindicator went belly up. And many surviving papers and digital startups have been left with skeleton staffs that lack the resources to do much digging and serve as community watchdogs. Nearly 60% of newsroom jobs have been lost since 2005, according to Medill. With many papers cutting print schedules, even large cities such as Pittsburgh, Salt Lake City, and New Orleans no longer have a daily print newspaper. This is a crisis for our democracy and our society, said Penelope Muse Abernathy, author of the Medill report. Why is this happening? The main driver, of course, is the shift to online readership, which destroyed the advertising revenue that once helped make newspapers profitable. Most of those ad dollars now go to Google, Facebook, and other sites. Newspaper revenues plummeted from $49 billion in 2006 to $14 billion in 2018, according to Pew. As many newspapers became vulnerable, Wall Street hedge funds and other investors bought them up at a discount and drastically cut staffs in pursuit of short-term profits. Half of America's daily papers are now owned by hedge funds, private equity firms, and other investment companies, according to a Financial Times analysis. One hedge fund, Alden Global Capital, has become notorious for cutting staffs to the bone, selling off assets, shuttering offices, and telling remaining staff to work remotely. Alden has left major papers such as the Baltimore Sun, the Chicago Tribune, and the Orange County Register struggling to cover the news with a small fraction of their former staffs. Alden papers in some locales, including Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and Vallejo, California, have been reduced to a single reporter. The phenomenon has given rise to the term ghost newspaper for publications that still publish but are essentially dead. Why is this important? For centuries, newspapers have played a crucial role in the nation's public life. They bind communities together, promote civic engagement, tell citizens how their tax dollars are being spent, and root out malfeasance by public officials. An informed citizenry is key to a functioning democracy. Studies have shown that communities without local news have lower voter engagement and social cohesion and fewer candidates running for local offices. One study suggested that a lack of local news contributes to political polarization and intense partisanship. Local newspapers serve as a central source of shared information, setting a common agenda, the authors wrote, while national news emphasizes competition and conflict. Some point to the recent election of serial fabricator U.S. Representative George Santos as an example of what can go wrong without a vigorous local press. What's the connection? If press scrutiny had brought Santos' lies to light before the November election, he almost certainly wouldn't be in Congress now. A small Long Island, New York weekly paper, the North Shore Leader, did sound the alarm about discrepancies between his claims and the public record, but no other media picked up on its reporting, including the Long Island Daily Newsday, whose once large and aggressive staff has been decimated over the past two decades. In years gone by, there'd have been 20 follow-ups from Newsday, said Leader owner Grant Lally. Santos' opponent, Robert Zimmerman, said he tried to bring red flags to reporters' attention, but many said they didn't have the personnel, time, or money to delve further. Can anything be done? A growing number of entrepreneurs, veteran journalists, and philanthropists are searching for new business models for both print and online journalism. One result is a proliferation of nonprofit news operations, from Mississippi Day today to the Baltimore Banner, started by a billionaire who made an unsuccessful bid to buy the Baltimore Sun from Alden Capital. The American Journalism Project, a venture philanthropy focused on local news, is helping to build nonprofit news startups like the new Ohio Local News Initiative. The nonprofit Report for America places hundreds of journalists in underserved communities. Last fall, California allocated $25 million to fund journalists working in understaffed newsrooms. All these developments are welcome, said Tim Franklin, director of the Meadow School's Local News Initiative. But as newspapers continue to shrink and die at a rapid rate, a more comprehensive way to fund local journalism is needed. The need to innovate is urgent, he said. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Californians may need to relocate. To adapt to a changing climate, people will have to move out of the places that have become too dangerous for habitation, said Mark Gongloff. And that includes large swaths of California. In just a few weeks, California has gone from perilously dry to being underwater as a band of atmospheric rivers unleashed torrential rain and rampaging floods and mudslides. At least $1 billion in damage is expected. The current deluge used to be seen as a once-in-1,000-years event, but climate change has made extreme swings between severe droughts and floods all too familiar. In California and elsewhere, people prefer to live near beaches, rivers, and unspoiled forests. But the flooding and mudslides even threaten the million-dollar homes of Oprah Winfrey, Ellen DeGeneres, and Prince Harry in Montecito. The only viable long-term solution to a warmer, more extreme future may be a managed retreat from places prone to repeat disasters. That would be especially tricky in California, since much of the state is vulnerable to droughts, floods, mudslides, beach erosion, and wildfires. But as extreme weather continues to claim a mounting toll of homes and lives, California may have no other choice than relocating millions of people. DeSantis authoritarian appeal. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is offering Republicans a step-by-step blueprint to turn the state into a political weapon, said Jonathan Chait. His latest foray into Viktor Orban-style authoritarianism is to remake the New College of Florida, a public liberal arts school, into an overtly conservative institution by appointing a half-dozen cronies and far-right ideologues to the school's board of directors. Among them is anti-woke culture warrior Christopher Rufo, who said restructuring the college is a first step for conservatives to reconquer public institutions all over the United States. A DeSantis aide said the goal is to remake New College into the Hillsdale of the South. Quite a goal, given that Hillsdale is a private Christian conservative college in Michigan. DeSantis is not merely trying to counter the woke intolerance of free speech found on many college campuses. He is actively seeking to impose controls of his own liking to silence progressive views on race, gender, sexuality, and religion. DeSantis fans reason that their enemies are illiberal fanatics, and so they have permission to use illiberal methods of their own. In his quest to become president, DeSantis is offering the authoritarian right a way to succeed where Trump failed. This column comes from the UK. U.S. wokeism pushes us away from Europe. America's culture wars are affecting British political attitudes, said James Marriott. People usually get more right-wing as they age, but surveys show that millennials in the UK are bucking that trend and remaining on the left. European millennials, though, are following the traditional path and growing conservative, even voting in large numbers for far-right leaders like Italy's Giorgia Meloni. Why the difference? It's likely because of English-speaking social media, which is dominated by U.S. arguments. Psychologically, many British people now effectively inhabit an American world, obsessing over American politics, American injustices, and American Supreme Court rulings. And because American millennials, horrified by the conspiracist anti-democratic American right, have remained progressive, so too have their British peers. The non-English-speaking Europeans, meanwhile, have their own internet spaces and are immune to this phenomenon. The West, once a monolith, is now splitting. While liberalism, with its promotion of free markets and free societies, could be applied around the world, America's new woke ideas are rooted in the specific racial atrocities of U.S. history. Americans are creating a new kind of culture entirely alien to Europeans. And thanks to our shared language, we in Britain are being taken along for the ride. Got an interesting title to our feature article this week, The Last Word. Night of the Dancing Geezers. In the college town of Ann Arbor, one club opens its doors on Friday nights to a much older set, said Joseph Bernstein in the New York Times. The clientele hasn't forgotten how to have fun. Ann Arbor, Michigan. Every Friday night from September to May, at an off-campus nightclub in this thriving college town, a group of die-hard music fans gathers to dance to some of the most devoted live bands in southeastern Michigan. There are women in skin-tight red dresses, long-haired men sucking down bottles of beer, and couples flirting in the alcove outside the bathrooms. In fact, just one thing distinguishes the crowd from nearly any other rock and roll show in a small city in America. Almost everyone is older than 65. Okay, two things. The show always starts at 6:30 p.m. and ends at 9 p.m. in time to get to bed at a reasonable hour. The party's official name is Ann Arbor Happy Hour at Live, but many people call it Geezer Happy Hour, Geezer Dance Party, or just Geezers. It's organized by Randy Tessier, a 72-year-old University of Michigan lecturer and writing instructor who has played in rock and jazz bands since he moved to the city in 1972, when it was a patchouli-scented center of American counterculture. From his windowless office in Angel Hall, festooned with posters of Karl Marx, Miles Davis, and Jimi Hendrix, Tessier books bands and runs the group's 2,700-strong Facebook community page. I call us the Silver Tsunami, Tessier said. There's a lot of us, and we still want to rock. Geezer Happy Hour is the latest iteration of a weekly musical happy hour that has been happening off and on, mostly on, since it started in the early 1970s at a one-room bar called Mr. Flood's Party. Over the years, the crowd has aged right along with the acts. Some people have been coming to the shows for 50 years. The turnout on a recent Friday night was typical. A convivial mix of finely preserved hippies, activists, professors, townies, amateur musicians, and an assortment of more than 100 other folk older than 60 who simply cannot stop dancing. They were dressed with unselfconscious flair. There were fringed jackets and fedoras, Western shirts and bow ties, rainbow bandanas and braided beards. Also, there were earplugs and a walker or two. All of the people got older and they're still here, said Tom Kinney, a happy hour long-timer wearing a purple tie-dye shirt and round John Lennon-style glasses. Over the years, the happy hour has wandered downtown from venue to venue, the Blind Pig, the Cavern Club, the Heidelberg, before settling at the generically named Live in 2013. The musical acts range from the almost famous, two members of Sly King, which put out a record on Columbia in 1975, played the recent show, to the famous for the night. They play rock, blues, soul, jazz, and country. Anything that gets the crowd moving, which isn't very hard. It's beautiful, said Dan Mulholland, a longtime Ann Arbor musician. These people will dance to anything. Mulholland, who was dressed in a classic rockabilly style and head-to-toe denim, plays gritty rock music that recalls hard-edged Michigan legends such as the Stooges and the MC5. Mulholland said he knew the young Iggy Pop. When Mulholland first performed at the Geezer Happy Hour, he said, he was taken aback by all the blue hairs. But then I looked in the mirror, he added, and realized that he was 73 himself. Among the dancers on the recent Friday were Judith Cawthorn, 76, and George Fahmy, 84, both retired. They first met on Match.com in 2010. Cawthorn had been going to the happy hour for years, and she didn't want to tell Fahmy about the party until she knew he could really dance. He was so much older than me, she said. So on their first date, she put him through the paces at another bar. Fahmy passed. Now Cawthorn calls him my sweetie, and the couple was among the first on the dance floor and the last to leave. Most people are dead at my age, Fahmy said, but tap twice on the table and I'll get up and start dancing. The staff of Live, which transforms into a bottles and tables dance club for young professionals around 10 p.m., adores the elderly crowd. They have the most fun, said Chelsea Anderson, a 31-year-old bartender who has been working the happy hour for 6 years. Everybody loves each other. It's a stark difference from the late crowd, where everyone is upset and barfing. Plus, Anderson said, the happy hour regulars are creatures of habit who rarely change their drink orders. The only downside, she added, are that they lose stuff a lot and have, on a few occasions, needed an ambulance. That night, dressed in a star-spangled T-shirt and jeans, Tessier played bass and sang in a five-piece band of veteran local musicians. The crowd was especially excited to see Peter Madcat Ruth, a virtuosic Grammy-winning harmonica player. Over two sets, the group tore through 20 songs, including the Beatles' Ticket to Ride, the Meters' Sissy Strut, and Santana's Sambo de Sausalito. They're the top elite of the Ann Arbor rockers, said Corky Waddles, 66, a retired salesperson. Between sets, Waddles and about a dozen other people ambled out onto South First Street to get stoned. Ann Arbor has been synonymous with marijuana activism for a half century. A December 1971 rally to free activist John Sinclair, Tessier's friend, then serving a 10-year prison sentence for possession of two joints, drew 15,000 supporters who watched Lennon and Stevie Wonder perform and Bobby Seale and Allen Ginsberg speak. 4 months later, after the Michigan Supreme Court ruled the state's felony cannabis law was unconstitutional, revelers held the first hash bash, like Mardi Gras, but for weed, on campus. We've been doing this for 50 years, said Ruby Butler, 73, between pulls off a small glass pipe. Only now, it's legal. Since Michigan voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use in 2018, dozens of dispensaries have opened in Ann Arbor, an irony not lost on a generation of crinkly-eyed ex-student activists. Wattles, sharing a joint, pointed out that the drug was great for seniors who use cannabis to treat conditions including arthritis and insomnia. Also among the tokers was Griff Griffin, 70, a retired computer consultant who described himself as a modern philosopher. Griffin wore a multicolored peace sign necklace and a single straw-colored dreadlock that he said he hadn't cut since the start of the first Gulf War in 1990. It's the only thing that keeps growing, he said. For its devotees, the Geezer Party isn't just a link to the past, but a sustaining communal ritual. Wattles refers to its members as her tribe, and the event itself as the Church of Dance. It is the most wonderful thing in my life, said Maggie Levenstein, another regular. It makes me happy every single week. Levenstein, 60, an economist at the University of Michigan and head of the Inter-University Consortium for Political and Social Research, the world's largest archive of digital social science data, works with data from the University of Michigan Health and Retirement Study. She has a wonk's perspective on the benefits of all that dancing and smiling. They are active and they have a community, she said. It is all these things people know are important to healthy aging, but no one individual person could create on their own. During the long pandemic lockdowns, Levenstein set up weekly Zoom sessions at the regular Friday time. Someone piped in music from Spotify. As many as 70 people at a time logged on to dance remotely. Among the only downsides of the older community, Waddle says, was that there weren't enough single men, although there was one guy whom she called the Creeper. He zeroes in if any single woman makes eye contact with him, said Waddles. Back inside the club, under a disco ball, the dance floor was packed. Someone had distributed glow sticks, which people were waving in time to the music. No one in sight was looking at their phone, a fact some in the crowd regarded with generational pride. I can't hang out with kids because they live in their cameras, said Angela Todd, 75, a gravelly-voiced woman with long blonde hair. They don't tap a finger or a toe. They don't feel music at all. Two young men who showed up early for the DJ set that would start later on, sat politely in chairs by the entrance, looking confused and impressed. At 9 p.m., the band finished with Gimme Some Lovin' by the Spencer Davis Group. By 9:30, most of the revelers had left, hugging and kissing on the way out the door. Some were headed to Zalgaz Grotto, an old Masonic social club on the west side of the city, where the dancing would continue until 11 p.m. But not Tessier. On stage, his band was breaking down its equipment. The player coach looked jubilant and exhausted. I've been married 3 times, said Tessier. I learned a long time ago to go straight home. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's a short business article for you. Global economy, China's historic slowdown. China's economy really suffered under its tight COVID-19 lockdowns last year, said Keith Bradshaw in the New York Times. Beijing reported this week that its economy grew just 3% last year, well under its 5.5% target. Except for the pandemic-ravaged 2020, it was the most disappointing showing since 1976, the year Mao Zedong died, when the economy declined 1.6%. The government has lifted the strict zero COVID rules that strangled businesses with frequent quarantines, but now the virus is sweeping through the country, infecting hundreds of millions of people and leaving factories, offices, and restaurants bereft of workers and customers. China's economic problems go beyond the virus, said Matt Phillips in Axios. Home prices are now deflating after a long speculative frenzy. A government clash with its formerly high-flying tech sector spooked investors. Tensions with the U.S. and other big trading partners are driving diversification away from Chinese supply chains. And China's population shrank in 2022 for the first time since the 1960s. Birth rates have long been slowing in China, a typical phenomenon as countries become more affluent. But this once unimaginable drop marks a major tipping point that could help make it all but impossible that China's economy regains its previous vigor. And we'll pick up a couple of short health and science articles. Ozone layer restored. It's not all bad news for the planet. New research shows that the hole in the ozone layer is on course to heal up completely. The ozone layer is a vital atmospheric shield composed of the gas O3, which blocks ultraviolet sunlight from reaching Earth's surface. In the 1980s, scientists sounded the alarm that human production of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, which were typically found in refrigerators, aerosol sprays, and solvents, had made a hole in the layer as the CFC molecules interacted with the ozone. But an international treaty, the 1989 Montreal Protocol, achieved wild success in phasing out these substances. Use of CFCs and other harmful chemicals has plummeted 99% since the treaty was adopted. And a new UN assessment says the ozone layer should recover to 1980 levels by 2040 across most of the world, and by 2066 over the worst affected region, Antarctica. Vigilance is still required, of course. A recent spike in the levels of one CFC in China led to concern that global cooperation was breaking down. But that turned out to be another success story. Martin Chipperfield, an atmospheric chemist who served on the UN panel, tells the Washington Post, communities came together and it was addressed. Hair test for autism. Doctors have developed a test for autism that young kids that uses a single strand of hair, reports NBCNews.com. The test, developed by New York startup Linus Bio, fires a laser at the hair to turn it into a plasma for analysis, then uses artificial intelligence to look for evidence of exposure to certain heavy metals that are linked to autism. In an initial study, it predicted the condition accurately about 81% of the time. The technology is incredibly novel, says Andrea Baccarelli from Columbia University, who wasn't involved in the study. It's groundbreaking. The test would be used only as a diagnostic aid, not as the sole means of diagnosis. The causes of autism remain a mystery, with risk factors ranging from pollution to changes in the uterine environment. Still, it could be a tool to help doctors identify the condition much earlier. The problem with autism is it's diagnosed at the age of 4 on average, said Linus Bio founder Manish Arora. By that time, so much brain development has already happened. We want to enable early intervention. And on the Talking Points page, we'll see if we have time for two, maybe three articles today. Abortion pill. Will prosecutors target women? The next front in the fight over abortion access could be your local drugstore, said Rachel M. Cohen in Vox. Most abortions in the U.S. are now performed through two medications, mifepristone and misoprostol, and the FDA recently clarified its rules to let pharmacies receive certification for dispensing mifepristone. Misoprostol has several medical uses and is more easily obtained. But in the 18 states that have banned or severely restricted abortion since Roe v. Wade's repeal last June, women are obtaining pills from various pro-choice groups through the mail, and state officials are trying to crack down. Alabama's attorney general, for example, vowed last week to prosecute women for taking the pill to end pregnancies, said Alana Vagianos in the Huffington Post. Alabama's abortion ban contains language explicitly stating that pregnant women are not its target, but State Attorney General Steve Marshall said he would rely on a 2006 chemical endangerment of a child law. Though he later backtracked, his comments hint at where the anti-abortion movement is headed. It was inevitable that red states would cross the don't push, punish the woman line, said David Dayan in the American Prospect. So as to not further anger women, many anti-choice activists claim that women who seek abortions are victims, and new state laws call instead for prosecution of doctors or anyone who helps women get abortions. But making it easy to get pills is exposing that approach's inherent contradictions. Since a pregnant woman is now frequently the only prosecutable person within a state's jurisdiction. For anti-choice zealots who consider every terminated pregnancy murder, criminalizing women is inevitable. Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Arizona also have chemical endangerment laws, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian, and will likely use them. Controlling and punishing women has always been the point. Even in states where abortion pills remain fully legal, the forced birth crowd are planning protests at CVS and Walgreens, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Anti-abortion groups have publicized plans to picket any pharmacy that dispenses mifepristone in eight cities, and they're lobbying for government protections for pharmacists of conscience who refuse to distribute abortion pills. The threat of protest might deter mom-and-pop drugstores from stocking mifepristone. CVS and Walgreens parking lots will soon join other contested ground the U.S. Supreme Court created. House GOP, why it's targeting the IRS. Regardless of how you feel about the Internal Revenue Service, said Alexis Leondis in Bloomberg, it's hard to refute that the current system to ferret out wrongdoers is terrible. The underfunded, understaffed agency, which relies on woefully outdated IT, fails to collect at least $500 billion in owed taxes every year. For individuals making at least $1 million annually, the audit rate fell from 8.4% in 2010 to just 2.4% in 2019. While the corporate audit rate was cut in half. In a move that would only make it worse, House Republicans voted last week to block most of the $80 billion allocated last year to modernize the IRS and bolster enforcement over the next decade. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates the GOP plan would increase the budget deficit by $114 billion over the next 10 years. Fortunately, this performative bill will never get past the Democratic Senate. Nobody's happy that the IRS is bogged down in about 10 million unprocessed tax returns from prior years, said Noah Rothman in commentary, or that just 13% of the 173 million phone calls last year reached an IRS representative after an average hold time of 29 minutes. The GOP doesn't object to providing funds to help the IRS improve these basic services. Republicans are, however, challenging Democrats' suspect claim that the IRS needs thousands of new agents to go after rich people and large businesses. There are just 700,000 Americans reporting over $1 million in income. And to find lots of additional tax revenue, a beefed-up IRS will have to go after the tens of millions of middle-income Americans and small businesses. That's where most of the money is. How courageous Republicans are for taking a stand against paying legally owed taxes, said Patrick T. Brown in CNN.com. But the undermanned agency, which has 33% fewer workers than in 1992 and faces a wave of retirements, currently focuses its August audits on people making less than $50,000 a year. High-income taxpayers are more likely to have expert accountants and lawyers on speed dial, making audits too expensive and time-consuming for the IRS. Since the 1990s, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, Republicans have deliberately gutted the IRS to benefit their wealthy donors while pushing to increase tax compliance requirements for low-income earners. Now they are insisting with a straight face that Democrats are the ones who want to protect rich tax cheats. Guns. When the school shooter is 6 years old. It's one of those only in America stories, said Jill Filipovich in CNN. 2 weeks ago, a six-year-old boy in Newport News, Virginia, took his mother's legally purchased 9mm pistol to school in his backpack and fired a single round into his first-grade teacher, Abby Zwerner, wounding her seriously but not fatally. Police say the incident was not an accident, unlike the hundreds of shootings by young children that occur every year. And police took the boy into custody but didn't charge him because of his age. The investigation is focused on how his parents stored the gun. Because of our country's insane gun culture, Virginia, however, lacks any laws regulating how guns are secured in homes. Adults who do not lock up their killing machines should be held liable for their negligence. Terrible incidents like this are rare, but happen more frequently than people realize, said adolescent psychiatrist Nancy Rappaport in WBUR.org. In at least 11 school shootings in recent decades, the shooter was 10 or younger. Our country has proven its willing to sacrifice our children's welfare to allow unchecked gun ownership. And more than 30 million children live in households with firearms. Most parents think the kids don't know where they've hidden their weapons. But one study found that 40% of kids were able to identify the hiding place, and many curious kids said they'd gone in and handled the guns. Not incidentally, half of all youth suicides occur from firearms. Think of the psychic damage the six-year-old shooter will suffer, said the Charlottesville, Virginia Daily Progress in an editorial. How far must we fall? With gun laws becoming more permissive, must we go about our lives with an eye on the nearest exit? Asked Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. In many states, it's now legal to walk into a store or restaurant or show up at a protest looking like Rambo, brandishing semi-automatic rifles, ammo, and tactical gear. It's not a crime until someone shoots. That atmosphere of perpetual menace has a chilling effect on citizens' ability to trust one another and to exercise their right to free speech. When even a first grader's response to conflict with a teacher is to shoot her, it's clear that permissive gun laws are a challenge to the very possibility of an open, democratic society. And we'll move to some short notes. Cancer deaths in the U.S. fell by nearly a third between 1991 and 2019, thanks to screening, early diagnosis, advances in treatment, and a decline in smoking, according to the American Cancer Society. Though cancer remains the second leading cause of death after heart disease, The drop has meant about 3.5 million fewer deaths over that period. Republicans have reversed a smoking ban inside the House of Representatives, which was instituted in 2007 by then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The ban allowed members to smoke despite a Washington, D.C. law that forbids indoor smoking, but only in their offices. Opening up other areas of the Capitol to smoking is all about freedom, said Representative Troy Nels, the Republican from Texas, who favors cigars. For the first time, renewable energy sources such as wind and solar generated more power in the U.S. than coal last year. Renewables generated 22% of total power, compared with 20% for coal. 43% of American schools have installed panic buttons or silent alarms that send alerts to law enforcement, up from 29% during the 2017-18 school year, according to new federal data. And we'll finish up with a quote from author Cormac McCarthy, who says, "Suffering is a part of the human condition and must be borne. But misery is a choice." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.